In the mid-1930s, as fascism swept through Europe and economic depression gripped America, Sinclair Lewis penned what would become one of the most prescient political novels in American literature. It Can't Happen Here shot to bestseller status upon its 1935 release, selling over 320,000 copies as anxious Americans grappled with the possibility that their own democracy might be vulnerable to authoritarian takeover. The novel's title became a cultural shorthand for political complacency that persists to this day. Lewis, already established as America's first Nobel Prize winner in literature, crafted this work not as a mere political tract, but as a deeply human story about how ordinary people respond when democracy crumbles around them. Stephen King has cited it as a major influence, while George Clooney once attempted to adapt it into a miniseries. Its renewed popularity during various political moments, including the 2016 election, speaks to its enduring relevance as a warning about the fragility of democratic institutions. In the fictional Fort Beulah, Vermont of 1936, newspaper editor Doremus Jessup watches with growing alarm as Senator Berzelius Buzz Winthrop secures the Democratic presidential nomination. Winthrop is a political phenomenon, a small man with an enormous bloodhound-like head and pendulous cheeks who transforms his physical ugliness into charisma through sheer force of personality. Though his speeches contain no intellectual substance and his platforms are wildly inconsistent, Winthrop possesses an actor's genius for connecting with audiences. He whirls his arms, bangs tables, quotes biblical wrath, then coos like a mother or pleads like a lover, all while jabbing crowds with facts that are often incorrect. What makes Winthrop truly dangerous is his authenticity as a professional common man. He shares and magnifies every prejudice of the American common man, from a love of buckwheat cakes to worship of Henry Ford to disdain for poetry and foreigners. When speaking, he creates the illusion of addressing each listener individually, revealing hidden truths. He promises to crush Jew financiers, grasping bankers, crooked labor leaders, and Moscow spies, while painting a vision of democratic paradise where humble workers would rule through honest representatives kept in check by a strengthened executive. Behind Winthrop stands the truly sinister figure, his secretary Lee Saracen, a mysterious man with flaxen hair and unsettling eyes who serves as bodyguard, ghostwriter, press agent, and economic advisor. Unlike the bombastic Winthrop, Saracen is a calculating intellectual who once dabbled in socialism and anarchism before losing faith in the masses during post-war nationalism. Now he believes only in oligarchic control, resembling Hitler and Mussolini in philosophy. It is Saracen who writes Winthrop's book, Zero Hour, Over the Top, a salty mixture of biography, economic program, and boasting that contains more suggestions for remolding the world than Marx and H.G. Wells combined. Winthrop's campaign centers around his platform, the 15 Points of Victory for the Forgotten Men. These points include establishing a federal central bank with absolute control over finance, recognizing approved labor unions while suppressing red unions, guaranteeing private property while limiting annual income to $500,000 and fortunes to $3 million, requiring religious allegiance while barring atheists and non-Christian Jews from public office, massively expanding military forces, doubling the money supply, prohibiting Negroes from voting, professional careers, and higher education, returning women to their incomparably sacred duties as homemakers, punishing advocates of communism or socialism with 20 years to death, paying veterans bonuses, and, most ominously, amending the Constitution to give the president unchecked authority while reducing Congress to an advisory role and removing the Supreme Court's power of judicial review. Doremus explains to his bewildered wife Emma that this platform is designed to threaten big business into supporting Windrup while enslaving labor, controlling preachers, preparing for global imperialism, punishing Jews who don't contribute financially, stealing jobs from Negroes, removing women's rights, and allowing persecution of anyone who opposes Windrup. Yet Windrup's supporters form a powerful coalition of the desperate and opportunistic: mortgaged farmers, unemployed white-collar workers, relief recipients wanting more aid, suburbanites behind on installment payments, American Legion members seeking increased bonuses, publicity-hungry preachers, Klan remnants, overlooked labor leaders, and struggling professionals seeking government jobs. Most powerfully, Windrup promises that average workers would receive $5,000 yearly, a fortune during the Depression. Elderly believers order new stoves and bathrooms to be paid for after inauguration, immune to Doremus's factual arguments against such dreams. Even idealists and intellectuals are drawn to Windrup's clownish swindlerism, seeing in it a free vigor that might rejuvenate capitalism. When Windrup wins the election, democracy crumbles with shocking speed. Within 8 days of his inauguration, he declares martial law and arrests over 100 opposing congressmen when they reject his demand for complete control. Lee Saracen explains to the press that the arrested officials are being safeguarded from threats. When riots erupt and protesters gather at the district jail where the congressmen are held, Windrup addresses his Minutemen, MMs, his private army, via loudspeaker, calling them the highest lords of the land and urging them to action. They open fire on the crowd, bayoneting those who flee. Congress, now intimidated and depleted, passes Windrup's constitutional amendments, while Supreme Court justices find themselves confined to their homes by Minutemen squads. Bishop Paul Peter Prang, who had been Windrup's most powerful supporter, flies to Washington to confront his former disciple. After 6 hours at the White House, he emerges pale and staggering. When a crowd threatens him outside his hotel, Minutemen rescue him to the district jail. The government announces they are protecting him from mysterious plotters, but opposition papers suggest he's been imprisoned for criticizing Windrup. When Prang's hometown organizes a protest train to Washington, they learn upon arrival that the bishop has gone melancholy mad and been committed to an asylum. No one ever sees Bishop Prang again. Windrup's first major proclamation justifies his actions as necessary during a crisis caused by powerful and secret enemies. He compares himself to Lincoln during the Civil War and likens his actions to a fireman rescuing a girl from a fire, whether she wants it or not. The country largely accepts this explanation, with citizens like Shad Ladue, Doremus's former handyman, caring only about promised financial benefits. Windrup announces the dissolution of all political parties, including his own League of Forgotten Men, replacing them with the American Corporate State and Patriotic Party, the Corpos. Following Italy's model, all occupations are organized into six classes, with workers and employers arranged in syndicates and confederations under a National Council of Corporations chaired by Saracen. Strikes are forbidden, unemployment disappears, as workless men are forced into labor camps where they earn a dollar a day, later $3 due to inflation, but pay most back for board and lodging. The regime's most dramatic change divides America into 8 provinces, eliminating states. Doremus now lives in Northeastern Province, District 3, County B, Township of Beulah, with layers of commissioners above him. Citizens resent losing state identities almost as much as not receiving their promised $5,000 government payments, which remain unfulfilled despite cheerful bulletins. The Minutemen, initially presented as a temporary campaign force, become a permanent institution with 562,000 members by June. Their ranks mimic military hierarchy, with titles like inspector, cornet, and brigadier, paying from $10 weekly to $16,000 annually for High Marshal Saracen. Many recruits come from college students, trained as officers, YMCA gymnasiums, young farmers, factory workers, and former criminals whose past is forgiven for their skills with weapons. As the regime consolidates power, its racial policies evolve from subtle discrimination into systematically enforced oppression. Social workers face a cruel choice: become informants against their own communities or face deportation to concentration camps operated by MMs, facilities that exist entirely outside normal prison regulations and judicial oversight. These camps, strategically placed in remote locations across the country, operate with impunity and without documentation of their activities. Local MM officers effectively become warlords in their districts, creating and enforcing their own arbitrary laws. They specifically target Jewish professionals, particularly doctors and musicians, along with Negro journalists, socialistic professors, and women who dare question the disappearance of their husbands, brothers, and sons. These designated traitors face escalating violence, from public beatings in broad daylight to midnight arrests on fabricated charges. The pattern becomes grimly predictable. First comes the warning, then the assault, and finally disappearance into the camp system. The propaganda war between the new underground resistance and the corpos reveals a stark imbalance in resources and reach. While resistance writers maintain their commitment to factual reporting and verified information, the corpo propaganda machine deploys an arsenal of influential voices, prestigious college presidents, popular radio personalities, and sophisticated corporate PR experts. Newspapers systematically purge liberal viewpoints and international news, replacing them with lurid content: comic strips that mock the underground, sensationalized drawings of crime scenes, and manufactured statistics claiming economic improvements and reduced military spending. Government officials commandeer radio airwaves daily to address their masters, while state-subsidized films glorify MM military might through carefully choreographed demonstrations of power. The distinctive American humor that many believed would set U.S. fascism apart from its European counterparts vanishes within 12 months. In its place emerges a familiar pattern of brutality: arbitrary arrests, systematic torture, and indefinite imprisonment, mirroring the methods of dictatorships worldwide. The regime's financial reporting becomes an exercise in creative accounting, masking economic collapse through elaborate deception. Military expenditures are buried in education budget lines, while wage statistics undergo mathematical gymnastics to conceal the extensive use of forced labor in the camps. Even basic economic indicators are manipulated. Unemployment figures exclude camp prisoners, while production statistics count their coerced output as voluntary labor. The transformation is complete when citizens begin to self-censor, watching their neighbors and measuring their words, knowing that casual conversations can become evidence of sedition. The machinery of oppression runs not just on violence, but on the fear that makes people willing participants in their own subjugation. At the center of this political maelstrom stands Doremus Jessup, the 60-year-old editor of the Fort Beulah Daily Informer. Born in 1876, Jessup represents 19th-century individualism rather than 20th-century conformity. His intellectual interests mark him as different. He reads widely from publications across the political spectrum. Though he describes himself as merely a mild, rather indolent, and somewhat sentimental liberal, he dislikes pomposity and self-importance in public figures while harboring genuine hatred for cruelty, intolerance, and contempt of the fortunate for the unfortunate. Doremus initially adopts a wait-and-see policy toward the corpo regime, but this becomes increasingly untenable as oppression tightens. The breaking point comes when Secretary of Education McGoblin murders two scholars during a drunken anti-Semitic rampage and is acquitted on grounds of self-defense against an alleged ritual murder plot. Doremus writes a scathing editorial condemning the murderous extirpation of honest opposition and calling Windrip and his gang pirates. The next morning, an angry mob gathers outside the newspaper office. Commissioner Shad Ladue, Doremus's former handyman, now risen to power, arrives with armed MMs and announces the Corpos will take over the newspaper plant. Doremus is arrested, imprisoned, and subjected to a mockery of a trial. When his son-in-law, Dr. Fowler Greenhill, bursts in demanding to know what the comic judges are doing, he is summarily executed in the courtyard. After his release, Doremus is forced to work under Emil Staub, the new editor of The Informer. Though he manages small acts of resistance, like his Yao Yao editorials, where he states strong anti-corpo arguments followed by deliberately weak rebuttals, Doremus hates this filthy slavery and constantly questions why he stays. Like countless others under dictatorships worldwide, he is caught between conscience and practicality, especially with a wife and family to support. When Walt Trowbridge, Windrip's defeated presidential opponent, makes a dramatic escape to Canada by airplane, he establishes the New Underground, a sophisticated network designed to assist refugees and coordinate resistance against the Corpo regime. The organization's reach extends across the northern states, with particularly strong cells in New England. Trowbridge's first act is to establish safe houses and escape routes, drawing on his extensive political connections from his campaign days. The resistance makes contact with Doremus through Mr. Dimmock, who initially appears as nothing more than a mundane insurance salesman making his rounds in Fort Beulah. This careful facade masks his true role as a key operative in Trowbridge's organization. The New Underground operates through four distinct but interconnected divisions: a propaganda printing operation that produces newsletters and pamphlets, a distribution network that disseminates these materials through seemingly innocent channels like grocery deliveries and church bulletins, an intelligence division that meticulously documents corpo brutalities and corruption, and an elaborate smuggling operation that helps endangered citizens escape to Canada. Doremus throws himself into the resistance work, establishing a secret printing operation in Buck Titus's basement, chosen for its remote location and Buck's reputation as a wealthy socialite above suspicion. Working with Dan Wilgus's expertise as a printer, they produce increasingly sophisticated propaganda materials, including their most impactful piece, How Many People Have the Corpos Murdered?, which catalogs specific instances of regime violence. Their local newspaper, Vermont Vigilance, becomes a vital source of uncensored news, distributed through an intricate network of trusted carriers. The Fort Beulah resistance cell grows into a diverse group united by their opposition to fascism. It includes Doremus's daughters, who use their social positions as cover, Buck Titus, providing both his basement and financial support, Lorinda Pike, Doremus's secret lover who runs a hotel that serves as a message center, Julian Falk, whose youth makes him an effective courier, Dr. Olmsted, who treats wounded resistance members, John Polycop, bringing his labor organizing experience, and Father Parafix, whose church offers sanctuary to fugitives. Mary Greenhill undergoes the most dramatic transformation following her husband Fowler's murder by the regime. She abandons her widow's weeds for bright clothing, a deliberate strategy to appear frivolous and above suspicion, while becoming the cell's most audacious operative. She leads increasingly dangerous missions, even pushing the typically cautious Buck Titus into riskier operations. Meanwhile, Sissy embarks on a dangerous intelligence gathering mission, attempting to manipulate information from Shad Ladue by feigning romantic interest, a strategy that nearly ends in disaster when Ladue becomes violent. Julian makes the bold decision to infiltrate the MMs, positioning himself as a valuable double agent who can provide advance warning of raids and arrests to Doremus's group. The resistance pays a terrible price. When Doremus, Buck Titus, Truman Webb, and Dan Wilgus are arrested, they face torture and interrogation. Doremus is brought before Provincial Commissioner Effingham Swan for trial, where Francis Tasbro and Shad Ladue testify against him. Based on this testimony and Dormus's own writings, Swan sentences him to a concentration camp with a minimum of 17 years, plus a suspended death sentence that would be enacted if he attempts escape. Swan orders 20 lashes as immediate punishment, and guards force castor oil down Dormus's throat before whipping him with a steel fishing rod until he loses consciousness. At Trianon concentration camp, Dormus is assigned as a cell sweeper and toilet cleaner. Through his cell window, he witnesses horrors, his cousin Henry Veder being executed after an escape attempt, Julian Falk and his grandfather brought in as prisoners, Julian being repeatedly tortured as an example, and the elderly Reverend Falk reduced to stealing bread from garbage cans. When Dormus refuses to betray Julian, guards bring in Reverend Falk, claiming each had betrayed the other. After an MM kicks the elderly minister to the floor, Mr. Falk, on his knees, prays not for forgiveness, but for God to curse his tormentors, for they know what they do, before collapsing, dead. Mary Greenhill takes the ultimate step in resistance. After enlisting in the Corpo Women's Flying Corps and mastering aviation, she pursues Commissioner Swan's official plane with stolen grenades. When her grenades miss their target, she makes the ultimate sacrifice, diving directly at the wing of Swan's descending plane. In her final seconds, she thinks of her childhood memories and wishes she'd spent more time with her son David as the planes collide in an appalling crash. After 2 years as dictator, Brazilius Windrip becomes increasingly paranoid and power-obsessed. Though he claims to want citizens healthy in purse and mind, he grows angry when neighboring countries reject his imperial ambitions. Demanding constant praise, he suspects anyone who doesn't flatter him of plotting against him. He expands his bodyguard, but distrusts them all, once even shooting at them. Meanwhile, Lee Saracen methodically consolidates power, becoming the true master of corporism. Buzz Windrip grows increasingly insecure, desperately seeking Lee's approval and friendship. Late one night, President Windrip awakes to find Lee Saracen, Dewey Hike, and Dr. Hector McGoblin at his bedside, Saracen holding a Bowie knife. Terrified, Windrip pleads, reminding Lee of past kindnesses. Rather than killing Windrip, they exile him to France. Saracen proclaims himself president, claiming Windrip had embezzled public funds and plotted with Mexico. In the once decorous White House, Saracen holds Roman-style orgies with weaving limbs and garlands and wine in pretty fair imitations of Roman beakers. Secretary of War Hike scolds Saracen for his negative influence on the nation and troops, but Saracen dismisses these concerns, calling Hike just an accurate military bookkeeper. Just 1 month after usurping the presidency, Hike marches into the White House with stormtroops, finds Saracen in violet silk pajamas among his companions, and shoots them all dead. When Dewey Hike becomes president, America truly begins to suffer. Unlike Windrip and Saracen, who tolerated merriment if it could be taxed, Hike dislikes such things on principle. He treats America like a well-run plantation where slaves are better fed than before, but kept so busy they have no time for debilitating vices like laughter or complaint. With the help of Lorinda Pike and squad leader Aris Dilly, Dormus escapes from Trianon concentration camp. After hiding in barns, spruce groves, and once atop a coffin in an undertaker's establishment, he arrives at an abandoned farmhouse where Lorinda and Sissy await him. The women transform his appearance, dyeing his hair and mustache black and shaving his beard. After 3 days of reunion, Dormus says goodbye to his two women and trudges into Canadian exile. In Montreal, Dormus serves in the Department of Propaganda and Publications for the New Underground, led by Walt Trowbridge as general chairman. Though he initially expects Canadians to thrill to his tale of imprisonment and escape, he discovers 10,000 refugees have preceded him, and his hosts have grown weary of pumping up new sympathy. Despite this, Dormus efficiently directs the NU office's distribution of anti-corpo literature while hoping for more dangerous assignment as a secret agent back in America. His opportunity comes in July 1939 when the Corpo regime manufactures a crisis with Mexico to distract from domestic problems. America rises as one man to answer this threat, drafting 5 million men to invade Mexico as soon as it should be cool enough. But the plans are interrupted by a popular rebellion against the Corpo regime that spreads across America's traditionally radical regions, from Sault Ste. Marie to Seattle. The rebellion gains legitimacy when General Emanuel Kuhn, chief of staff of the regulars, declares for Walt Trowbridge as temporary president. As William Barton Dobbs, a traveling salesman for harvesting machinery, Doremus works undercover in Minnesota. Operating as a secret NU agent with 60 operatives under him, he travels between farms organizing resistance, using tailored propaganda for different ethnic communities. Though he questions some of his tactics, he finds joy in seeing his converts jeering at frightened Minutemen recruits marching to Mexico. The novel ends with Doremus escaping a Corpo posse, heading to a hidden cabin where quiet men awaited news of freedom, with Lewis reminding us that a Doremus Jessup can never die. Lewis's novel presents fascism not as a sudden revolution, but as already embedded in American ideological worldviews. He draws clear parallels between his fictional elements and real fascist regimes. Windrip's Zero Hour, mirroring Hitler's Mein Kampf, the Minutemen resembling stormtroopers, and characters modeled after Nazi officials like Goebbels and Goering. The novel meticulously traces how democratic institutions gradually erode through seemingly minor compromises and concessions, each step making the next easier to justify. The transformation unfolds through familiar channels. Local newspapers being pressured into self-censorship, community organizations falling in line with new political expectations, and neighbors beginning to view each other with suspicion. Lewis shows how fascism exploits existing social divisions, particularly economic anxiety, racial resentment, and cultural grievances. Windrip's promises of restored greatness and economic revival resonate deeply with a population feeling left behind by rapid social change and financial instability, much as similar promises had attracted followers to European fascist movements. When Doremus reflects on his own complicity in fascism's rise, he realizes, the tyranny of this dictatorship isn't primarily the fault of big business or demagogues, it's the fault of Doremus Jessup. This self-indictment carries particular weight because Doremus represents the educated, liberal middle class, those who should have recognized the danger signs. He blames himself and other comfortable, respectable citizens who hadn't protested fiercely enough against encroaching fascism, who dismissed early warning signs as temporary aberrations or exaggerated threats. The novel's most unsettling aspect is its portrayal of how ordinary citizens accommodate themselves to fascism, not through immediate conversion to its ideology, but through small acts of compliance and rationalization. Business owners who once opposed Windrip begin to see advantages in the new system. Intellectuals find ways to justify their silence. Neighbors report neighbors, not out of genuine belief in the regime, but from fear or opportunity for personal gain. This remains perhaps the novel's most powerful message, that democracy's greatest threat isn't external invasion, but internal complacency, the belief that it can't happen here. Lewis shows how democratic societies can unravel not through dramatic upheaval, but through the accumulated weight of small surrenders, each seemingly reasonable in isolation, but devastating in their totality. The warning resonates beyond its historical moment, suggesting that the mechanisms of democratic decay remain remarkably consistent across time and place.